welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind, and we are coming to you live from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam. This is the fortnight during which we go through the beautiful book, compilation of conversations that Dr. Hislop has had with Bhagwan, or rather conversations which he was part of, because there are other people also conversing with Swami, asking beautiful questions, and Swami is giving even more beautiful and profound answers. And that is the conversation we are going through in this series. The book that we are following, of course, is Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba by Dr. John Hislop. And I think this is the 9th episode or so, and we've already touched upon so many varied topics. And we can see that the questions which are being asked are anything from profound to mundane, but the answers are, of course, always very deep and thought-provoking, and that's what gives us the opportunity to dwell deeper on all of these and ask questions to understand for ourselves what is Swami actually driving at. And that's been a beautiful exercise so far. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed it. So before we begin this week's episode, we offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet and pray that He inspires our thoughts as always. Sai Ram Arvind.
Sai Ram Prem. And diving directly into the subject, we continue from where we had left off last fortnight. So a visitor is now telling Swami, a visitor means one person possibly whom Hislop doesn't want to name. That's also, it's only Hislop and rest everybody is visitor, second visitor, third visitor. So visitor is telling Swami, one hears talk of mantras. To which Swami replies, just the repetition of a mantra is of no value. But if the mantra is chanted with full knowledge of its significance, it has great effect. Now this is something so profound and valuable, because many times spiritual aspirants that we get enamored by this concept of a mantra, repeating which, you know, everything can be attained. It is something mystical, it is something magical. That's why, you know, we get drawn towards it. Anything that we don't understand, either we fear it or we are in awe of it. And mantra is one such thing that we are in awe of. And Swami is actually breaking that down by saying that it's no use if you don't understand it, what it is. Because I remember many times, many scholars, many Vedic pandits, many wise people, many teachers, many elders, when Swami gives his discourses, they say, every sentence of Swami is a Vedavakya. Vedavakya means it is a statement of the Vedas. In fact, there is that famous episode wherein one of the pandits, Vedic pandits, I forget his name, I don't know if it was Kamavadani Garu, or when he was asked whether whatever Swami says,
I think Kamavadani Garu.
Kamavadani Garu, yes. He was asked whether whatever Swami says is in the Vedas, you know, is Swami really quoting the Vedas? He reprimanded the person who asked the question and he said, don't make the mistake of asking like this, because it is not as if whatever Swami says is in the Vedas. Whatever Swami says, that is the Vedas. That is the Vedas. Which also makes a lot of significant meaning, because today we have lost more than 70% of the Vedas, 80% of the Vedas. Vedas were something that were transmitted only through word of mouth, orally, and because of the decline in that wonderful culture, we have lost so many of the Vedic texts. So it is not as if we have a complete Veda manuscript, because Vedas were never in the manuscript form. It's not as if we have it in the complete manuscript form now that we can actually check whatever Swami is saying also. Anyway, the important thing is, whatever Swami says is a Vedavakya, meaning each statement itself can serve as a mantra. But then, when Swami has spoken so much, when we have so many mantras available, why are we not able to possibly make that grand progress or achieve ultimate enlightenment that we wish to get from a mantra? It's only because of lack of perseverance with the mantra and lack of full knowledge and understanding of that mantra. You know, I may say that, yes, Swami says, take any statement if you take. Swami says, help ever, hurt never. And we say, you know, I have been helping and I have not been hurting, but nothing has happened to me. Which means I have not understood what it is what it is when it is said help ever, hurt never. So before we blame or before we think that something that Swami said, Swami has assigned, it is not working for me, it is not helpful, let us always keep in mind that Swami is always right. So if at all something is not giving me the desired result, it must be something that is wrong in my practice or the way I understand it. Because this kind of attitude and this perspective will actually help us to grow in our spiritual endeavors and efforts.
Going back to the idea of the mantra itself, you know, there is this, in Sanskrit they always have this beautiful, each word will have a phrase which actually explains it, especially words which are made of
multiple, each syllable, you mean?
Right, multiple syllables. Right? For mantra, it is said that manana trayate iti mantra, which means a mantra which is thought about will take you to release or freedom.
That it protects
it
you. Yes.
It protects you. It you know, helps you, gets over, across the ocean. I mean, that trayate actually has multiple meanings. Whatever it is, it rescues you. That's the general meaning, one could say. So when you say manana trayate, it means you think over it, and you cannot think of a mantra without going into the significance of the mantra. And I think that is where most of the time the mistake lies. In fact, I'm not able to find that. There's one beautiful interaction between Swami and the youth during one of the youth conferences where Swami said, if you have any questions, you can ask me. And one of the youth had asked this question about the Gayatri Mantra. And the question was, you know, Swami, how should we chant the Gayatri Mantra? Some people even tune the Gayatri Mantra and sing it. Is that all right? And, you know, they say that it's very particular that you should pay attention to the intonation and the way it's pronounced and all that. I mean, I was just imagining what Swami's answer to that would be. And probably Swami would have said that, yes, it is very important. You know, it's all in the sound and vibration and you should chant it that way. But the answer which Swami gave was completely different and so down to earth. You know, Swami said, see, you say Gayatri Mantra. Who is Gayatri? Gayatri is the mother. And Swami said, do you have to call your mother in a certain language, in a certain meter, in a certain manner for her to respond? Mm. You only have to call to her with surrender, with dependence, and with love. Right? So Swami said, the essence of the Gayatri Mantra is love. So when you're chanting the Gayatri Mantra or singing the Gayatri Mantra, are you able to say that, mother, I'm calling out to you, please come and enlighten me? Swami said, that is enough. It doesn't matter how you chant it, whether you sing it out or you chant it out or you do it silently under your breath or do it loudly. I mean, I think that is the one thing, is the broad way in which Swami opens up the path of spirituality to everybody. But also the essence, what Swami is saying here. You know, Swami is so beautifully saying that you have to understand the potency of that mantra, the significance of that mantra. Without that, yes, it will help. Swami has said that in other places also, because there is a vibration which goes with some of these mantras and that will help to a certain extent. But to have the complete effect of that mantra or the complete benefit, you cannot have it without, you know, dwelling into the inner significance of the mantra.
And that is why possibly, you know, Swami does not prescribe one mantra as the solution for everything.
Right.
You know, because it's not just about the mantra, it's also about our understanding of the mantra and our sincere practice of the mantra. For instance, I myself am aware of at least two occasions where Swami had said that I will give you a mantra which is a secret for everything and which will help solve everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And on each of those occasions, Swami gave a different mantra. One occasion was I was not physically present, but I've heard this about how Swami had said that he would go to the Institute auditorium and reveal the secret. And when everybody had gathered, they were at the, you know, sitting on the edge of their seats because this was going to be a blockbuster moment for them. Swami said that the mantra is, you keep telling yourself, I am not an animal, I am a man. And then Swami said, that's not all. You also say, I am not man, I am God. At that point in time, for many, it seemed almost like an anticlimax. Like, what's so great about this? But that is what Swami gave as the mantra. On another occasion, Swami said, there's a mantra that will help you deal with all difficulties in life. Everything will lose its effect to make you feel down, low, sad and all that. And again, after great suspense, Swami revealed the mantra is, this too shall pass. And this too shall pass, meaning don't worry, it's a passing cloud, it will go. So on the face of it, it appeared like this is so simple, it can't be a mantra, because we are so conditioned into thinking that a mantra has to be something complicated, something that I don't understand. If I understand it, it can't be a mantra. That is a wrong notion that Swami is shattering here, because he's telling that if you think that something that you don't understand, something which is very complex, is a mantra, it's no use. Because a mantra has its potency only when you understand it completely. And with that understanding, you follow. For instance, personally, one mantra that I follow from Swami, I mean, at least I try to follow, is that it's a Telugu mantra actually. You know, it is, Idi na manchi kosame, which means, this is for my good. So irrespective of what happens to me, good or bad, happy or sad, in my perspective, when it happens, I just tell, Idi na manchi kosame, this is for my good. But simply telling this doesn't have a calming effect. But when you understand it, why is it good for me? Because my life is in the hands of my Swami, who is very powerful, in fact the most powerful, and very loving, in fact the most loving. The most powerful and most loving being in the universe is taking care of me. And therefore, whatever he is planning for me has to be for my good, right? Once this understanding comes, then you feel, yeah, this is for my good. So anything that happens, maybe somebody comes and tells that you have done a great job, or somebody else comes and tells that you have done a pathetic job, you are not worth. I mean, I'm just giving a basic criticism versus praise kind of scenario. Both, you feel that, this is good for me, that is why Swami is making this person tell this. This is what I need, that's why Swami is giving this to me. It's like I'm hungry, I am given food, I'm thirsty, I'm given water. I'm in need of the criticism, that's why criticism is being given to me. Therefore, I should be happy, because whatever I need, my Lord is fulfilling it. So therefore, this is good for me. So in order for this mantra, Idi na manchi kosame, to work for me, I need to have, first of all, the faith and perseverance so that I remember it in every situation. And then the understanding behind why that mantra comes, so that it's effective. These are a few thoughts that come in mind when I think of the mantra.
Even when you were saying that, you know, Swami has given multiple mantras which are, which probably in our minds don't qualify to be a mantra. Because, you know, actually if you go back to some of the scriptures and say that every mantra should start with an om, it should, you know, have these many syllables or something like that would be there. It should be in Sanskrit, you know. I think in Sanskrit, and Dharma, we insist that it has to be in Sanskrit.
Yes. Mm.
And I think one of the Guru Purnima time also Swami had said that I'm going to give you a mantra which is very, very important. And then Swami said, the mantra is Devudunnadu. Said, the mantra is that God exists. And he said, if you're able to remember this all the time, you know, that is what a mantra is. Mantra is something that you remember all the time. And Swami said, if you remember this all the time, you'll never be disappointed, you'll never be despondent, you'll never feel that I've done good but bad is coming back to me, or, you know, why should I be good? All of these questions will go off if you just remind yourself that God is there. God is there. God is watching, you know, whichever way you want to look at it. And that's why, you know, when you're telling about Kamavdanya, I just remembered the exact sentence what he said. He, when asked, you know, whatever is Swami speaking, he said, there in the Vedas, he said, what are you saying? Swami mate mantramu, he said.
Hmm.
He said, Swami's word itself is mantra. So that is what it is. We don't need any other mantra to listen to what Swami has said and to think constantly. And, you know, I think as students, we've heard this from so many of us elders and seniors, where Swami would say something which sounds very trivial or sounds very mundane. But there are people who will go on thinking about it, and then they'll say, now I understand. This is what Swami was saying. Swami was referring to this particular event which had happened, or this particular doubt I had in the morning. Something as simple as Swami would say, Kurcho, Swami would say, Tarvata, or Chustanu, or something. But that will mean so much. That can happen only if you have this belief that Swami Mate Mantram. Whatever Swami says is a mantra worth remembering and recapitulating.
And then as Swami answers this question to the visitor, another visitor asks, Swami, how can we improve memory? This is a very beautiful question. Very practical and interesting question, because as youngsters, as students, as people who are in different professions, we all would love to know the technique or method in which we can improve memory. And the beauty of Swami is, Swami actually goes always to the root. to the root rather than just give some external technique or method. He goes to the root secret behind everything, and that's what he does here also. I will read out. It's a detailed answer. I will just read it out. Swami says, "There is not much use thinking about the past because it is gone. Trying to memorize is not of much value. We will naturally remember that in which we are interested." A small story. Arjuna was 85 years old, a middle-aged man. In those days, people lived much longer. Arjuna said, "Lord, how is it that you can remember all the past lives and I cannot?" Krishna replied, "Well, what were you doing 10 years ago on the third day of the month?" Arjuna said, "I do not know." Then Krishna said, "Well, you were alive then." Arjuna replied, "Yes, I was alive." Krishna then said, "Look back, Arjuna. 60 years to the day, you were married. Do you remember that?" "Oh, yes," replied Arjuna, "I remember that." "Then look further back, Arjuna, to that day when you met your guru and you were taught the martial arts. Do you remember?" "Yes," replied Arjuna, "I remember." Then Krishna said, "It is obvious that people remember that in which they are interested. That which was sufficiently intense to cause them to remember the incident. But they do not bother remembering that in which they are not intensely interested. Now you do not remember 20 years back, but you know you were alive then. Therefore the memory is there, but you cannot recall it." "Now I remember everything, Arjuna, because I am interested in everything."
Beautiful. Actually, I think Swami has said this on many, many occasions, even in discourses, especially this example of Arjuna and Krishna, where, it's such a practical example. We ourselves can think Arjuna is 80 years old, but even in 30, we can look back and remember so many things, and the number of things that we have forgotten is so much more than the number of things that we remember. And among the things that we remember, we will, if we were to see what is the nature of those events which we remember, we will come to know how self-centered we are. You know, how most of it is only about ourselves, our achievements and our failures and our desires being fulfilled and all of that. That's how self-centered our lives have been. But that also shows that in which you place your interest, you'll be able to remember so much. And
Interestingly, when you were saying this, I was just thinking, when I looked at my own personal diaries, of course, most memorable are our interactions with Swami. So there have been a few instances where Swami is speaking to a group of us, and I have my diary entries. And in the diary entry, if you read my diary entries, it appears as if I am the protagonist there, because it looks like the maximum number of conversations are happening between Swami and me. But the truth is, that's because that's what I'm interested in. That's what I recollect after the interaction. And even as early as 24 hours after the interaction, I predominantly remember the interactions in which I was involved. Because today, almost a decade or a decade and a half, sometimes even two decades after an event has happened, when I catch up with some of my classmates or some of the others who were present during that interaction, and, you know, we relive those beautiful times, when I hear what they say, you know, "And Swami said that, that has made so much meaning," I feel overwhelmed, and I think, how on earth did I miss this, man? I missed it at that time simply because it did not directly concern me at that point in time. So even in something as valuable and as magnificent or as important as Swami speaking, we choose and pick only those portions that are relevant to us, because that's what we are interested in. That's what happens even during a discourse. That is the reason why if after listening to a half an hour discourse, I am told to summarize the discourse, I may not be able to do a summary that is justified according to you possibly, because your summary may vary depending on what you need, whereas my summary will vary depending on what I need. So definitely such a beautiful message here, that our memories totally depend on what our interest is in. So what we remember, what mental baggage, what memory baggage we carry in our life is not anybody's fault or anybody's is being the cause. The cause is ourselves. Where we have focused, where we have given interest, that is what we carry as our memory and mind. As Swami tells here, Arjuna, you remember clearly that you were alive 20 years back, which means memory is there. But recall is not there, because 20 years back on the third day of the month, what was happening was not interesting enough for you. Whereas your wedding, your memory is also there, your recall is also there because you are so interested. So this is such a very important point, and it's also an indicator for us to pay attention to only those things that actually matter in life, because otherwise we'll be simply carrying and lugging around a baggage that's of no use to us.
And I think that's what Swami says here. I think the crux of what Swami is saying here is that it's no use carrying the baggage of the past. Unless and until it's of interest to you, then of course, in our definition of what is interest to us itself is quite vague and quite wrong sometimes. But the very idea, you know, when Swami always says that live in the present, when Swami says that there is something of interest to you that you can recall, which means that which is of interest to you from the past and which can positively influence your present is only that which is worth carrying in your memory. If something is going to hurt you, something is going to, you know, suck your energy away, something is going to pull you down or make you, you know, lack in confidence, it is not worth remembering, right? What is of interest to you in the present is only what you have to carry in your mind, not something which is, you know, revenge or anger or hatred. It's not worth carrying any of these things. In fact, you know, when we first joined Swami's university, I mean, it used to be really fascinating the way some of the teachers used to recall, you know, incidents and experiences with Swami. And I mean, it used to be a joy in itself that you could speak to any of them at any point in time and you can be sure that there will be something related to Swami that's going to come up. And I used to wonder, you know, I mean, one thing is we are struggling to keep in memory what we are studying for our exams itself. And these people are like able to remember so much about Swami. And I think that itself was an indication that if you want to remember Swami, you give interest to Swami. And if you want to give interest in Swami, then try as much as possible to remember Swami as many times in the day as possible. I think it's both ways it's helpful in that sense. If you want to remember something, ensure that you pay attention and tell yourself that this is of interest and importance to me. Or if you want to give importance to something, ask yourself, how often are you remembering it? How often are you recollecting it? And when you want to give importance to Swami, I think that is the, you know, corollary of that. How many times in the day are you remembering Swami? How many times in the day when you wake up and you go to sleep in between, are you able to, you know, in some form or the other, bring Swami to your memory? Be it as a prayer, be it as a conversation with Swami, or, you know, looking at a picture or looking at a video, whatever it takes, but ensure that you go back in your thinking as many times as possible to Swami.
Another interesting theoretical point that comes out here. I say theoretical because I still don't know how you practically apply it. But theoretically, Swami actually has revealed how he is omniscient. Because, he has done it through Krishna. When Krishna tells Arjuna that I remember everything because I am interested in everything. So that begs the question, why is Krishna interested in everything? That we can get the answer by asking ourselves, why am I interested in some things? I am interested in those things which are of consequence or importance to me. And when I say me, I am referring to my body-mind apparatus. Because that is what I consider as me. That is why if somebody comes and tells me that, you know, in the country of Zaire, in the third village over there, one of the taps, water has stopped coming. Okay, fine. And by the end of the day, you ask me, which country did I mention to you? I may not even remember. Of course, now I'll remember Zaire because it was off my mind. I just said it and it's not a country that I possibly often discuss, you know. but the thing is, I'm not interested because I don't think it's related to me. Me meaning my body and my mind. But for Swami, when Swami identifies himself with everything in the universe, everything is of interest because everything concerns him. That's how it is. And this is what I was saying is the theoretical idea, theoretical concept that comes. The true selflessness is being interested in everything because you are in the Atma Bhava. Everything is me. You know, ekoham bahusyam, that one became many. So everything is me actually, and that is the reason I'm interested in everything, because of which I'm able to know everything about everything, which is why I become omniscient. So also, since we are self-centered, we are concerned only about ourselves, therefore our memory is so limited. As we broaden our heart, as we start, you know, expanding from possibly myself to my friends and relatives, to my family, to my community, to my society, to my country, as Swami would call it, expansion love, I think automatically our memory also would go up, because we are interested, and we are interested because it all affects me, not just my body and mind, me, because I am more than my body and mind. So this is a, as I said, an interesting theoretical concept that comes out so beautifully through these words of Bhagwan.
In fact, you know, there is a concept in Vedanta where they say, when you're inquiring into who you are, they say that, you know, you are seeing a sight, so you are different from what you are seeing, right? So similarly, something is looking at your vision itself. You know, let's say that I start developing some power in my eyes. I'm able to see that earlier I was able to see clearly, now I'm not able to see clearly. So they say that there is something able to see the state in which your eye is.
Mm.
Right? So you are separate from your eye, or in that sense you are separate from your senses. And then they say similarly, you know, one day you wake up and you find that you're just cheerful for no reason. You know, you just find that it's going to be a very nice day. Or some days you just wake up feeling so low and, you know, burnt out early in the morning itself. So then they say that there is something in you which is able to see the state of your mind. Right? You're able to say that today I'm cheerful or today I'm very sad. So there's something which is able to see your mind, so which means that you're not your mind. You are seeing your mind. Right? So then they go on to say that why are you then only able to see your mind? And you're not able to, you're attached to yourself, so you're able to see only your mind. That body consciousness of I am this body is what attaches you to the mind. And that's where that, that phrase which Swami would often sing, Sarvadhi Sakshi Bhutam. He says God is not the seer of only one buddhi, but he is Sarvadhi Sakshi Bhutam. He is able to see everybody's buddhi. So if you give up body attachment, you actually go to that level where you're able to see everybody's mind as your own mind. You're able to see everybody's body as your own body. As you just said, it's absolutely theoretical at this point in time. But I think it happens automatically when you get purified in that sense of, the practical example we've seen is the way Swami would remember so many things. And, you know, so many times we've seen that, especially during an alumni meet or during when old students are there and Swami goes to the old students block, Swami would remember such detail. And this is not the divine aspect of Swami, right? The divine aspect of Swami is omniscient. He doesn't have to remember everything. Everything is known to him. But even physically, you know, Swami will remember, and Swami would remember with associations, just like how we usually remember, right? When you meet a person, you will say that, you know, I met you when I had gone there, or, you know, I was speaking to so-and-so and you had come and I had introduced you to me. That is how we remember with associations, right? So Swami would remember people with associations like that.
Of course, the ultimate example is Swami. The other day, my wife, Pooja, she was telling me that she's amazed at some of the primary school teachers. Every 31st of every year, they have their primary school alumni meet. And she says that some of the alumni, their children are now about to pass out of the primary school. I mean, that is the number of years there is a difference. But each and every alumna is amazed at how even to this day those teachers remember their likes, their dislikes, what curry they like.
Right,
what,
absolutely.
She says that, Pooja was telling me that possibly you can tell that a mother remembers like that for the child. But okay, one children, two children, 10 children, okay. 100 of children across batches, you remember the batch, you remember their parents, you remember this, you identify them. It is humanly impossible. There is something magical, she was saying, and I feel that today Swami has given the answer. When you are genuinely interested in 1,000 children, you remember each child's like and dislike. It's not just a number. The child is not just a number. The child is one unique entity with so many characteristics and traits that you remember. Possibly, as parents, we have like that kind of interest in our children, that's all. Or maybe the cousins of our children, a few. And about those 7-8 people, we are able to remember. But when you have that interest, so in that sense, it also becomes practical because we have seen that happening. Yeah, Swami would do that with all the students. But to a certain extent, we see even the teachers doing that, which is phenomenal, which means that it can be developed. And it's not as if the teachers here are all those who have an IQ of beyond 140 and they have been geniuses, they are memory magicians, nothing like that. They are, in the intellectual sense, they are as, you know, as average or normal, like anyone. But it is their interest and their passion that gives them such phenomenal memory. So, yeah, we have examples to look up to.
Right. So I think at this point, again, there's going to be a change in the theme. So we'll take a break here, dear listeners, and we'll continue this conversation, because it's an interesting conversation in that sense. The theme changes quite drastically. As we said, it's not only Hislop. There are multiple people here. So there are different strains in the discussion, and I think it'll be interesting to go through all of them.
In fact, in today's discussion, I think Hislop doesn't feature anywhere at all. It's all different visitors asking their questions.
Right. So don't go away, dear listeners. A short break and we'll join you again after that.
Saundarya Sara Sarvasvam Manasmita Manoharam Vandaru Janamandaram Vande Sai Maheshwaram Vande Sai Maheshwaram Satya Sai Smaranam Smaranam Parthi Sai Smaranam Satya Sai Smaranam Smaranam Parthi Sai Smaranam Tribhuvana Paraka Sai Mahesha Satya Sai Smaranam Tribhuvana Palaka Sai Mahesha Satya Sai Smaranam Satya Sai Smaranam Smaranam Parthi Sai Smaranam Shri Guru Charanam Bhava Dukkha Haranam Shri Guru Charanam Tribhuvana Pala ಬಾಲಕ ಸಾಯಿ ಮಹೇಶ ಸತ್ಯ ಸಾಯಿ ಕರುಣ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ ಪತಿತಾಯಿ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ ಶ್ರೀ ಗುರು ಚರಣಂ ಭವದುಃಖ ಹರಣಂ ಸತ್ಯ ಸಾಯಿ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ ಪತಿ ಸಾಯಿ ಸ್ಮರಣಂ.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we are at that point where an interesting thing happens in the interview where about which we are discussing. At this point, of course, if those of you who just joined us, we spoke about a question which was asked to Swami, how one can improve memory, and Swami explains that when you have interest in something, that is what you tend to recall and remember for a long time. At this point, one of the visitors, you know, pulls out a professional camera and he says, Swami, can I take a picture now? And then Swami asks in English, how many are here? And then Swami starts counting. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12. Okay, 12. And somebody says, Swami, 12 disciples. And then Swami says, this is my camera. And Swami opens his hand and there are 12 small pictures of himself amid much exclamation from the group. Keep them in your purse, Swami says. See, 12. Full addresses also. Address here in India. No camera, no film, no flash. A visiting card. Puttaparthi is the address. And this is what Swami suddenly materialized these. I think earlier Swami used to do that. Visiting cards with Swami's picture and the address. The complete address of the ashram. So Swami materializes 12 for the 12 people over there and gives it to each one. And then Swami starts opening a silver box and starts preparing his pan leaves. And then one of the visitor asks, Swami, what is this?
So, before we go into the pan box, I was just thinking one or two things. The visitor who said 12 disciples, I think he is possibly referring to the apostles. They were 12 in number.
Okay.
So maybe he's like telling Swami 12 disciples as if like we are your apostles, you are our Lord that way. And it's very interesting that visiting card, it is circulating on some of the WhatsApp groups and it's also in social media of Swami black and white with the address P.O. Penukonda, that kind of visiting card. And it reminds me of the episode where, you know, Swami shows his empty hand and asks what is there in it. When the devotee answers that, Swami, there is nothing in that, Swami then closes it and opens it and there is a beautiful ring or a gift. And Swami says that this hand in which you think there is nothing, this nothing is everything. And then Swami says the world which you think is everything, that is actually nothing. I just remembered because this happened, this episode also happens in the interview room. And once again, Swami is doing that. It's so beautiful. And the way Swami also does it, you know, as if he has to count and how many of you are here? 2, 3, 4. And he's stressing there it's in English because I think Swami is speaking in Telugu and there's a translator there. A translator who's translating. And we saw that in the previous discussions where once or twice the translator comes and speaks something that is in his mind. So therefore in English Swami is counting. It is so sweet. All this actually make the episode memorable. Swami doesn't need to know how many are there. He knows if he can materialize that, he can do that. But Swami you know, in that sense, sets up a nice interaction. So Swami counts how many are there. And I remember once being in the interview room and Swami was counting like this. You know, Prem, there is so much of joy when Swami counts you also. That it also gives so much joy. And I feel that's why Swami does all these. You know, for that brief moment when Swami looks at you, points his fingers towards you and gives you some number, assigns and says 7 or 8. That also feels so special. And I feel that is the reason Swami does anything. Swami does anything or everything that he does so that somebody or the other is feeling special and getting a memory to cherish. That is what Swami does every time. That is what Swami has done throughout his earthly sojourn, through his avataric sojourn.
And in fact, Swami used to say that, you know, I think one of our colleagues, Arvind Sai, used to say that at one interview when Swami was giving them so much of love and affection, they kind of submitted to Swami. They said, Swami, you're giving us so much. You're, you know, showering us with so much love. So Swami said, you know, don't say that it is too much or so much and all that. Swami said, when Swami gives, you accept it. When it is not there, you remember what was given and lead your life, right? So when you say that Swami was making the, you know, that interaction memorable, I think that was the thing which always Swami used to do. Because people would often ask, you know, why Swami has to materialize and why Swami has to do this. Nothing that Swami does is without a purpose. You know, the message is the most important thing. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, how do you drive the message into that person? You know, and we started off by saying that. Swami says you have to remember. The mantra has to be remembered and it has to be, the significance has to be recollected. And the next thing is Swami saying that what you have interest in, you will remember. You know, something exciting happens, you remember. I think that's the example that Swami gives. Swami gives the example of Arjuna's marriage and when he, for the first time, as a student of archery, he goes to his master. So something which is exciting and interesting to you, you remember. And Swami is making these interactions interesting in these ways by ensuring that it's not just about the discussion, but also something that you will recollect years later. And then you will say that, okay, when Swami materialized this, Swami said this and that, and this was the question and this was Swami's reply, probably.
You know, I think that's why spouses get wild when you forget the wedding anniversary. Because it's not about you forgetting the wedding anniversary, it almost gives a message that you're not interested in me. So that is it. And as you said, Swami now opens a silver box and starts preparing leaves. Leaves meaning the beetle leaves. A visitor now asks curiously, Swami, what is that? And again, in English, Swami says, this is the nut, the beetle nut. This is the leaf. See the leaves and this is the beetle. This is not a bad habit. If it were a bad habit, Swami would not chew it. The leaves juice purifies the blood. The nut digests. Here, they mix the nut and give it for digestion even to the little puppies. And the other thing that is put in is calcium. The three mixed make red color. This is Indian. You know, Swami proclaimed this is Indian. And there is a merriment among all the foreign visitors there because Swami is stressing on this being made in India. So that there's apparently a very casual conversation because he's asking what is this. And we know that Swami had his own silver box in which he would keep the betel nut, the leaf and the chunnam as we call it. Right. Or the white lime. Yeah, right. To apply and have it. The most important statement, most beautiful statement for me in this whole interaction is when Swami is saying that it's not a bad habit because if it was a bad habit, Swami would not have it. That's all it is. So this is not just an avatar of words. This is an avatar whom you can follow. Let me clarify on this. You know, it has been said that follow the actions of Rama, but follow the words of Krishna. Because Krishna's actions were done in multiple dimensions, you will not be able to understand it. But in this avatar, you know, Swami is embodying both the traits of Rama and Krishna. That's why this is an avatar whose words you can follow, whose actions also you can follow. And you know, that is the reason why possibly, you know, many people say that he is God. Why did he discriminate against the women? I recently got a question like that. You know, why did Swami keep the women away from him? Why did he give less of himself to the girl students? That's because this is an avatar that's a combination of Rama and Krishna. You know, there are people who are not just following your words, they are also scrutinizing your actions. They follow your actions as well. And therefore, he performed his actions perfectly according to what he expects the men to do. That is why, because he has come in the body of a man, he did everything that he expects the men to do, and that is how it is. And the same thing is highlighted when he makes this statement and he says that it is not bad. It's not a bad habit to eat betel nut and betel leaf, because if it was bad, why would Swami do it? I would not do it.
And this used to be really such a beautiful thing in those days, because we know that later Swami stopped doing it. That again was for a reason, where he had that interaction with the devotee. I think we mentioned that many times. But so many times, when you look at...
I think Dr. Banerjee.
Right, I think Dr. Banerjee, who had the habit of taking notes.
Yeah, who was replacing Dr. Gokak at one of the Sahitya Academies or something. Okay. Mm-hmm. He had to replace him, and Swami saw that his kerchief was dirty because of the snuff.
Right.
And then Swami said, before advising him, I should give up this. Yes.
Right. Now, if you look at it, especially, if you go to Sanatan Dharma, you have these various deities. If you had, we recently had the Ganesh Chaturthi festival, or before that we had Krishna Janmashtami. Each of these deities have specific preferences, and, there are ways by which it is easy to worship those deities, if you could put it that way. If it comes Ganesh Chaturthi, what would please that
Modaka.
Lord. This is what is characteristics of his likes and preferences.
Mm.
So similarly, I think, even if you look at Swami and if you compare it with the Shirdi avatar, you would find that there are so many differences. I think those are ways by which these divine personages can be related to and worshipped. Because even when, physically, when Swami was of the habit of taking that pan, so many devotees who had the opportunity to, worship Swami probably through that one little habit that Swami had. I recall one of our very senior alumni brothers, Mr. Malikeshwaran, who works in the hostel. He was saying, that it was such a beautiful habit. Swami used to have a very beautiful, small, cute little silver box in which Swami used to keep all that pan, and that used to always be on Swami's, the stool next to Swami's chair. And it used to be such a delightful sight even to see Swami picking up that leaf and making that pan for himself. It used to be so meticulous and so precise the way Swami would do it. Nothing casual about it, nothing, not putting too much of anything, too little of anything. It was so perfect just to observe Swami doing that. And he was saying that, that became a process by which they could do something for Swami. So they would go back home and they would learn different types of pan making and come back and make pan for Swami, right?
Mm.
And that used to go as part of Swami's lunch. And Swami would say, oh, this is different. And then Swami will call the boy and he would say, Swami, this is Calcutta pan and I learnt it when I went home and all of that.
Mm.
And that would become prasadam eventually, right? Because they would make three or four and Swami would have one and send back the remaining. Of course, he says that, Swami left the habit, but I am not able to give it up. Because I started eating the prasadam and now I can't give up the pan habit right now.
Interesting that you brought up even Shirdi Baba, because I think tomorrow is... Shirdi Baba's...
right, exactly.
It is...
27th September. Vijayadashmi was the day on which he took Mahasamadhi.
Samadhi,
right?
Okay. So, it is that.
And yeah. It's also the, 100th year, right? 1918, 27th September.
Yeah, and it's 2018.
Right.
So, thank you, Swami, for bringing that up in the discussion so that we remember your previous shariram during the afternoon satsang. Speaking of pan, multiple times when Swami has used the example of pan in his discourses, and I came across one example, there are multiple ways in which Swami has used pan as an example, like how he would use a handkerchief as an example. And here is one example from the 16th of August 2006,
mm-hmm.
where Swami says, if you wish to have pan, you must procure three items, betel leaves, which are green, the betel nut, which is dark brown, and slaked lime, chunnam, which is white. Only when these three ingredients are chewed together, will your mouth and lips become red. Where did the red color come from? From the betel leaves? From the betel nut? Or from the lime? Not any one of them exclusively. Only when the three items are chewed together, does the red color appear. Similarly, God is in all the three. Brahma the creator, Vishnu the sustainer, and Maheshwara the destroyer, coming together. The unity of all these three aspects is divinity. So, simply, just to show how Swami would use a pan, it was so close to his heart in every sense. And not only would he chew it, he would also use it as an example. So, I just narrated this. And now, the interaction goes on.
Right. And then, one of the visitors asks another interesting question. He says, the pictures that people take of Swami and then produce for sale are not good pictures. They do not do justice to Swami. Swami is perfect and everything around him should also be perfect. And then Swami replies, some may like one thing and others may not like the thing. The liking and the disliking is not in the object, but in our minds. If a person judges just from appearance, then it indicates a lack of depth. First, they should know Swami and then make a judgment. Then the visitor goes on to say, but Swami is beautiful and the pictures make him ugly. It's quite a rude thing to say, Swami. Tell Swami, I think. And then Swami says, and Swami answers very beautifully. He says, love is the beauty. And then Swami's translator, as usual, as you mentioned, he every now and then tries to explain Swami a little further. And so the translator adds, Swami says that because we love him and see the beauty. So
because we love him, we see the beauty, yes.
Yeah, because we love him, we see the beauty. So whoever wants to come will come to him. You need not get upset because of pictures.
Right. So the translator, assuming that the person who is asking this question is asking it because the pictures are not so good and therefore they are not able to, in quotes, market Swami properly to the world.
I think even Swami is saying that they should come and see and, you know, they should not, then they will automatically feel.
Right? Ah, yes, correct.
So I think...
Yes, Swami is saying that, correct, huh?
Right.
You know, on this note, I'll just tell that if anybody wants really beautiful pictures of Bhagwan, come and pick it up from our Sri Sat Sai bookstore. They've got the most amazing digital printing unit which brings out the best colors, and at least the best color that I have seen, and they've got a really good collection of photographs. I feel there are multiple options available for any altar or anything in the world. So yeah, definitely I would like to present this and make the facts be known. So that is the best thing. But going back to this discussion that Swami is saying, Swami is saying again a very, very important aspect to remember, that liking and disliking is not based on what the object is. It is based on what you are within. Common day examples, there is a food dish that somebody loves and it is his or her favorite food dish. But that same food dish happens to be something that the other person cannot tolerate. We have that situation at home, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a vegetable which is one person's favorite, which the other person cannot stand. For example, the capsicum. Somebody loves the capsicum, somebody hates the capsicum. So it is not the glory of the capsicum that somebody loves it. It is not the meanness or badness of the capsicum that somebody doesn't like it. And that is what Swami is telling here. It is what you are that makes an object beautiful or not so beautiful. So, you know, it reminds one of what Swami would often say, Yanta matramuna yavara talachina anta matrame nenu. Meaning, what is the importance, value and feeling that you give to me, that is what I become. You consider me as the supreme mother, I become the supreme mother. You consider me as a great person, I become a great person. You consider me as a magician, I will be like a magician for you. But you consider me as the supreme divine who can confer you moksha, I become the supreme divine and I will confer on you moksha. So that is what it is. So Swami is telling you, don't worry about how the photo is looking, because it's all perceptions. It is not about the actual object.
And you know, this is actually a thing which Swami would mention in many occasions, and to explain the most important thing of, you know, Swami would say, from sakara to nirakara, you know, to think of God, even to develop love for a formless God, Swami would say, is very, very difficult. You know, if you think of him as somebody who is disembodied, who, you know, does not have any of the qualities that you value. He does not have compassion, he does not have love, he does not have sympathy. It's very difficult to fall in love and to think and adore a God like that. So Swami would say, it's easy to have start with sakara or with a form. You start worshipping a form. And then Swami would say, see, that is why I have come. And, you know, Swami is here very humbly saying that, you know, it's all in your eyes. The beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Swami would say this to students. See, I've come in such a beautiful form. What more do you want to meditate upon? And Swami would say that it's so pleasant. And Swami would also say that it's so simple. One of our seniors was saying that when Swami is talking about meditation in the bhajan hall, Swami was saying, see, it's so simple, this body. See, if you have to meditate upon Lord Shiva, you have to remember the crescent on the thing, you'll have to remember the serpents, you'll have
the
to
Ganges,
remember the third
the
eye,
the Trishula, the
Damaru. There's so many paraphernalia to remember and, you know, imagine as you think of the form. Same with Lord Vishnu. You know, each hand has a different thing and there's so many
heads. I still don't know what is in each hand. I know Shankar Chakra, Gada,
right?
Padma.
And, you know, and then Swami was saying, but see this Sati Sai form, it's so simple and sweet. You know, there's a halo of hair, beautiful eyes, very beautiful face. And then you see the neck, and zoop, you can come up to the feet. So I'm saying there's nothing, no, straight it is there. Then you can look at the feet. So I'm saying, so it is so easy to meditate upon this form. And, you know, it is not by default that a beautiful form has come as Satyasai in that sense. So, I mean, I don't know. I find it difficult to agree with what this person is saying, that Swami's pictures do not do justice to, I mean, that is definitely there. You know, when you see Swami in person, it's a different experience altogether.
But no way can you call it ugly,
yeah,
man.
No way can you say Swami's pictures absolutely do no justice. You know, there are many, many people who are actually taken aback by even seeing a picture of Swami, by seeing, you know, how,
distinct,
yeah,
unique,
I would often say that, you know, when you have to look at each feature and say that, an eye should be like this to be beautiful. An eyebrow should be of this shape to be beautiful. Or a nose should be of this shape to be beautiful. Actually, Swami's face does not follow any of those definitions of marketable beauty. But together, it's a beauty that, you know, probably only God could have come up with a thing that challenges all your concepts of beauty and still it is beautiful, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. What you say really makes sense, because I did not know where you were headed. And when you said that eyebrows, what is the perfect, I actually looked at Swami's eyebrows and thought, no, this is not, they will say, this is not what people would call as the perfect eyebrow. And you said the perfect nose. I was thinking, no, this is not possibly what they would call. And then you landed in that anticlimactic dialogue where you said that none of this match the conforms to what are the standards. And yet, overall, it is so mesmerizing. Absolutely. So like you, I also beg to differ from this gentleman. But that is Swami's love, that with this rude statement also he's not taken aback. He just goes on to say. Interestingly, Swami also gives an example. He says, Johnson, you know, Johnson the English writer. There's this Samuel Johnson, a great English writer and scholar. I think he passed away in 1794 or something, but a great thinker. And Swami has quoted him many times. So Swami is talking about him, and Swami says, he had an ugly wife, but he loved her so much. A friend said, your wife looks old and made up. She did not look young and beautiful. Friends thought she looked old and made up, but he thought that she was the most beautiful, because love is blind. You know, Swami is quoting and saying, so it's all a matter of your love. When you love something, it becomes beautiful. If you don't, it doesn't. I think we already had a discussion on the capsicum before that. So, an interesting thing here is, again, just like the pan, Swami seems to have a, you know, great regard for Dr. Johnson. Because again, when I was searching, in multiple discourses, I came across Swami referring to Dr. Samuel Johnson. So, on that note, I'll just share one more discourse clip where Swami is saying, in the Shivratri of 1955, Swami saying, a person once told Dr. Johnson, the famous English thinker, that he could seldom get time to recite the name of God. What with the hundreds of things he had to do from morning till nightfall and even far into the night. Dr. Johnson replied with another question. He asked how millions of people found space to live on the face of earth, which is two-thirds water and the rest is full of mountain, desert, forests, icy regions, riverbed, marshes and similar impossible areas. The questioner said that man somehow struggled and found living space. So too, said Dr. Johnson, man must somehow find a few minutes a day for prayer to the Lord. So, Dr. Johnson is definitely high on Swami's list, and this is another beautiful message that when you have interest in something, not only will you remember it, you will also find time for it, you will find it in your priority list, and therefore when you say that, you know, I would love to think of Swami but I don't have time, it just means I'm not interested. Again, goes back to what Swami had said in the beginning. Because if I'm interested, I'll naturally find time. And, you know, in the same discourse, another associated point, which is beautiful, which I'll just read out. Swami says, to a worldly person, a God-intoxicated man will appear mad. and the person will laugh at him for it. But to the God-intoxicated man, the worldly appear foolish, insane, misled and blind. Of all the insanities that harass people, God madness is the least harmful and the most beneficial. The world has suffered untold damage due to its mad rulers and mad guides. But nothing but harmony, peace, brotherliness and love have come out of God madness. I just thought it's so beautiful because it came in the same discourse, Shivaratri 1955. So, that's about it.
Right, and I remember another beautiful Chinnakatha. I think, I don't know whether Swami narrates it or it's part of folklore, where, you know, there's again an Akbar Birbal kind of a story where Akbar once asks his ministers in the court. He says, you know, he's got a grandson who he's very, very fond of. So he asks the people in the court, isn't my grandson the most beautiful child in the whole kingdom? And who would, you know, challenge the views of the king? So everybody says, yes, your highness, he's definitely the most prettiest child in the country. But Birbal says, you know, he wants to tell him that his, as what Swami was saying here, you know, you find it beautiful because you love that child. It's not because the child is actually the most beautiful.
There's no absolute standard for beauty.
Exactly.
Huh?
So Birbal says that, no, my lord, I've seen actually a child who's more beautiful than yours. Right, and then Akbar challenges him, bring that child to my court, I'll see. So what Birbal does is, he actually goes and he carries away the child and he kind of hides that child. So the mother of the child comes to the court, saying that my child is missing. So then Akbar asks his mother, describe your child. So then the mother says, it's the most beautiful child in the kingdom. Right, I mean, my day does not go without seeing the child. It's the most prettiest face and
pearly teeth, lovely moon-like eyes.
All of the description she gives. Then Akbar says, thinks that, you know, probably this is the most beautiful child. And then after that, Birbal brings the child, which actually probably is not as beautiful as the royal child. Right? It's a
not
simple,
as pretty, possibly.
Right? It's a commoner's child in that sense. You know, not really fed and brought up in that manner. You know, automatically probably not as well nourished as the royal child and all that. So then Akbar looks at the child and said, but this is definitely not the most prettiest child. And then Birbal says, you know, my highness, it's the reason, the same reason why you find your grandchild the most prettiest is the same reason why this lady finds her child to be the most prettiest. And in fact, you know, if you remember, I think in the earlier conversation, so Hislop asked Swami, how does one develop love? Right, and Swami says, love starts with the feeling that this is my God, or this person belongs to me. So it's the same thing. When you find that somebody belongs to you, find it easy to love that person. And when you love that person, you automatically find the good things in that person that are likable, that are lovable, and that you find that are worth remembering, right? So it is in that sense. So I think that is the conversation here in that, should we take a break or should we?
Yes, I think we'll take a quick little break, dear listeners, because again there's a change in topic and theme here because another person is asking a question. So after the break, we'll continue with the discussion.
Madhava Sai,
Madhava Niranjan
Welcome back, dear listeners. We'll go to the next question which is being asked here. A visitor at this point asked Swami, how does one get devotion to God? And Swami's answer to that, we'll just read that out. Swami says, confidence is necessary. Food is the origin. The body is made from food. Without health, it is very hard to do anything. The stomach is of four parts. One quarter air, one quarter food, and one half water. Too much food is taken nowadays. There is no room for water. In India, rice and wheat are standard. They are all right if taken in moderation. But people eat too much and become dull. Too much food results in dullness of mind. Food in moderation does not result in sickness. Swami travels to various parts of India and does not get sick from food. Swami becomes sick only when taking on the sickness of a devotee. Otherwise, never. Too much milk is bad. It is rajasic.
This is amazing and interesting because the question is how to get devotion to God, and Swami starts dilating on food.
Right.
Which shows that food is the basis. Food is the, Swami would say, jaise ann, vaise man.
Right.
As is the food, so is the mind. And vaise tan, even the body. In fact, I remember a discourse in which Swami was stating that people think that a lot of ghee and wood and things are being wasted by burning them in a yagna. And Swami would say that them saying that all these good substances, ghee which can be used to feed 10 people, is being wasted in a yagna, Swami would say it's equivalent to somebody going and telling a farmer that you can use that sack full of grain to feed 20 people. Why are you throwing that grain into the sand, into the soil in your field? Yes, that sack can feed 20 people, but if it's put into the field, it can give a yield which can feed 200 people. Swami would say that is what the yagna is doing. And in that discourse, Swami explained, you know, that, you know, the smoke from the yagna, when it results in the clouds, clouds are formed because of condensation of water around particles only. Swami would say that smoke from the yagna, it is around that when the clouds are formed, that rain, when it nourishes the crop, leads to such good food, that food will actually lead to people of good character. You know, with the arrogance of being scientific, we may just say that all this is nonsense, we may laugh at it, you know. I'm not saying as devotees, but even as devotees, we may listen with reverence because Swami has said, but we may have our own doubts within, but when we believe that Swami has said is true, that is what it is. It affects, and sadly, just because we don't realize it now, it feels foolish. Copernicus was actually condemned to death for stating terrible things, such as that the sun is the center of the universe. But 100 years later, that is what is worshipped. 100 years later, people worshipped that. People accepted that. And today, that is anybody's basic knowledge. Who knows, 100 years from now, everybody might know that. You know, today, the rains that we get are formed around particulate matter that is spewed out from the exhaust of our vehicles and industries. Not only are they physically polluted, I feel even a spiritual sense they are polluted because the vibration they carry is that of selfishness. Instead of that, from the Yagna, when you have, you know, the Dasara Yagna is coming in a fortnight from now. From the Dasara Yagna, when you have well oxygenated smoke, scientifically speaking, you don't have black smoke and grey smoke, you have white smoke. So which is pure in terms of the physical thing also, compared to a black smoke or a grey smoke. And then the vibrations it carries is that of Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu. May all the beings in all the worlds be happy. And then the rain comes. So, you know, when Swami states like that, these are all deep things on which we possibly have not given importance. Therefore, when Swami says that food is the basis for devotion to God, it is something we have to pay a lot of attention to. Because we think we love Swami, but we eat whatever we want. Junk food, meat, alcohol, we push in through the mouth all sorts of substances which abuse only the body possibly we think, but we don't realize that it's affecting the mental body as well as the spiritual body, because that is what Swami is saying. And Swami is saying that a stomach should be only one quarter with food. Only quarter stomach we should be. And we say that we ate full stomach. Half of it should be water and one quarter air. Oh my God, there are so many things for us to pick up and learn from this.
Right, and I think another way of probably looking at this, because when he's asking about how does one get devotion, Swami is going off into food. If we recall, I mean, though it appears like Swami is taking off in a completely different direction, I think one thing could possibly be, this is the most appropriate answer for the person who is asking the question. Mm. Right? And this might be it, one thing which is going to change the way he is going to look at his spiritual path. That is one way of looking at it. The other way is, we happen to do one entire satsang on the Bhrigu Ali, right? Where the student starts off by asking, what is Brahman? What is the ultimate? He starts with food, actually. He starts with the first realization he comes back with, he's saying that food is everything. And then we saw how it actually goes from the Annamaya Kosha to the Anandamaya Kosha. It is gradually one goes through that entire process. So there we saw everything starts with the realization that, you know, you have to ensure that what enters this body is in the, you know, is purified. And the other way of looking at it is, I think later Swami is going to talk about that. You know, when you're talking about, Swami mentions even you have become a human body because of the food that the parents have eaten. Mm. So one way of looking at it is also because I think most of us can say with a fair bit of confidence that if we believe in God today, it's because we were born in families which, you know, did not question the existence of God. I mean, after a certain time, you can have your own reasoning, but by default, I think we were born in a family where we were told that God is there, worship him or worship her, and these are the pujas that you have to do. So in a sense, it also means that, you know, where is your source coming from? Are you born in a family where it is belief is there? Or are you in a situation where whatever you take inside your body, not only as food, as Swami would say, everything that is taken into the body through the senses is food, is what you're taking into the body substantiates this idea that there is God? Because Swami starts by saying you should have the confidence, right? When I was telling about that Guru Purnima discourse where Swami says, the fundamental thing is believe that God is there, that confidence and faith that God is there. And that comes when you're able to ensure that the people around you also prescribe to that same idea and help you, you know, stay firm on that belief that there is God, even though you don't see him, even though you speak to him and you don't hear him replying to you.
And coming to the physical aspects of food, a point that Swami keeps making every time is that too much food results in dullness of mind. I remember when we had done the satsang on sealing on desires, we had this very interesting discussion where we were discussing what is bad and what is good. And at the end of that fruitful discussion, we concluded that nothing is as such good or bad within limits. Anything that goes beyond limits becomes bad. So even if it is food, food is something that is absolutely necessary. It is vital for our existence. But too much of food is bad. That is what our scriptures say, Ati sarvatra varjayet. Meaning, give up everything that is in excess. See, going scientifically also, we breathe in oxygen. And we need oxygen for survival. But you see, it is oxygen that is responsible for us to age. I will not go into those details now because we don't have the time. But our aging is because of the oxygen that we take in. Once the amount of oxygen we have taken in exceeds one particular level, we start moving towards death. Our body starts dying. Which means too much of oxygen is also bad. Oxygen is needed for survival. But 70 years of oxygen is enough to kill you actually. It's possibly the slowest poison known to man. If you just search for oxygen as slow poison, I think you will find many articles on that. So you see, when it becomes very difficult to classify something as good and bad, but one thing for sure, that anything in extremes is bad. Everything in moderation is good. And therefore, Swami is stating the same thing for food also, saying that food in moderation is good. That is why that actually solves a lot of our health problems. It will also solve our mental problems if we are able to eat in moderation.
And of course, the beautiful point that Swami is making is Swami never falls sick. You know, because at that time, I think the 70s, Swami was traveling extensively. And you know, nowadays, one change of water, you know, you go from here to another city and you drink water there and you say, oh, I'm having a bad throat, change of water. Right. Or the food has changed and you fall sick. You know, we used to find that with boys in the hostel when we used to come to Parthi during festivals. Even that change of water, we would fall sick, you know, even though Parthi is our home in that sense. But Swami is saying that I'm traveling so much, I never fall sick. And Swami so beautifully says that if at all I fall sick, be sure that it is because I've taken on somebody's sickness and it's not because of any... Just like what Swami told about that pan eating habit. It's not because of me overeating or indulging or doing anything which is wrong. It is always because only I've chosen to do that to this body.
And that itself, you know, again, going to the 24th of April 2011, when Bhagwan chose to leave his physical frame, when Swami says that Swami becomes sick only when taking on the sickness of a devotee, otherwise never, that never holds true for everything. So therefore, you know, to find people to blame or things to blame or reasons, I think all that is just a foolish exercise, because the ultimate truth is Swami decided that that is how it should be and that is how it is. I think it every statement of Swami gives so much of meaning to different things that have happened in different points in time, and that is how it is going to be. Because after this, Swami goes on to talk in detail about the foods that particular visitor wants to have. Unfortunately, right now we don't have the time to go into that. So at this point in time, dear listeners, we will conclude with this and we will continue with this discussion the next week when we take up this Conversations with God, Conversations with Swami. We hope that you are enjoying this as much as both Prem and myself are enjoying. We are learning. We are grateful to Swami for this opportunity, and we pray that we get the opportunity to spend our thoughts, our words and deeds for him and for him alone. We'll end this satsang with a bhajan or a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love. So, till we meet you next week, thank you. Jai Sai Ram. Nadir dum,
దాని దిలకిటజం మదని దకిటజం గపసత కిటజం మదని దకిటజం గపసత దకిటతో సదని రమగరి సత కిటతో సదని రమగరి సదనల తో సదరి దారి నాదుర్గో నాది దుర్గం తిల నాదుర్గీతన తో తరికిటదోం తగిడదోం తజనుత తరికిటదోం తగిడదోం తజనుత తరికిటదోం తగిడదోం తజనుత తరికిటదోం తగిడదోం తజనుత తన తో